Well, good morning, dear friends. It is good to be with you. We've been hearing over the last few weeks about the Jesus that is presented to us in the pages of the Bible, and particularly the Gospels. We find that Jesus is presented to us, firstly, as a Son of Man, the Son of Man. He's one of us. He's like us. He has our humanity, but he's not really like us at all. We find also that he is the Son of God. He's much more, though, than a superhero, a miracle-working superhero. He embodies divinity. And so we find that God himself can be approached. We find as well that he is presented to us as God's friend. That is, he shows us what real wisdom in life looks like. And at the same time as showing us real wisdom, he loves desperate fools like us, people who get themselves into all sorts of scrapes and difficulties, people like us. And as a result, what we're being told is that there is greater meaning and purpose in this life than we perhaps can currently appreciate. This Jesus is vastly more optimistic about us than we are about ourselves. Or perhaps to put that in a slightly different way, his assessment of us is far deeper and far more accurate than our own self-assessment. If you really want to find out about who you are and who I am and who we are as a humanity, then we look to Jesus, not just deep into our own souls. But last week, we also found that Jesus is man's friend. The Bible calls him a friend of sinners. It's interesting that the Bible is not afraid to use that term. He takes upon himself our fate and secures in that way for people like us a wonderful eternity. If his assessment of us is deeper and far more accurate than we can possibly know, then he also promises us a greater eternity by far. So we are far more broken than we ever dared imagine, and far more loved than we ever dared to hope. And now we're going to hear what the early church started to think about this Jesus as they encountered him and as they thought about the legacy that they've been given.
This reading is taken from Colossians chapter 1, and we're beginning from verse 9. For this reason also, since the day we heard this, we haven't stopped praying for you. We are asking that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding, so that you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing to him, bearing fruit in every good work and growing in the knowledge of God, being strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, so that you may have great endurance and patience, joyfully giving thanks to the Father, who has enabled you to share in the saints' inheritance in the light. He has rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of the Son he loves. In him we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For everything was created by him, in heaven and on earth, the visible and the invisible. Whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and by him all things hold together. He is also the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have the first place in everything. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile everything to himself, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Once you are alienated and hostile in your minds, expressed in your evil actions, but now he has reconciled you by his physical body through his death to present you holy, faultless, and blameless before him. If indeed you remain grounded and steadfast in the faith and are not shifted away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard. This gospel has been proclaimed in all creation and under heaven, and I, Paul, have become a servant of it. Amen.
Well, welcome back. If it would help you, please have that little passage we had read, that excerpt from the book of Colossians. You'll find it in a Bible. You can click to any device you have and find it in the Bible there, or maybe you'll have a book open in front of you if you have a Bible at home. Over the last few weeks, we've been urged and invited to investigate this Jesus for ourselves. It could be that actually you're clicking in, you're logging on for the first time, and you've got to that point in your life where you're saying, what if this Jesus is now becoming a real person for me? What if he's going to leap off the page and actually he's one of those people that I want to get to know him better? A little bit like Aslan, the Narnian lion, did for me when I was a kid, or if you've watched the recent production of Hamilton, an American musical, Alexander Hamilton or George Washington leaping out of history and becoming alive in a way that you hadn't expected and you haven't appreciated before. What if this Jesus is becoming somebody that you want to know? Or perhaps I want him to know me. What then? What should happen next? What's going on in my mind? What's going on in my heart? What should I do about it? You'd never imagined in your life that you'd go to church or you'd want to go to church. And of course, right now, you kind of can't. But now you're listening to someone talk about Jesus. And now you're thinking, do I go back over the last few weeks to see what they said then? And he is becoming more real to you than ever. And believe me, you're not alone in this. This is happening across the world. This is happening across the country. People are more and more interested in this person, Jesus, more and more interested in reading the Bible for themselves. But yeah, it's scary. You didn't expect to be here. Or maybe you've never imagined that you can't go to church. You'd never imagined you not going to church. And this last 4 months, or maybe even longer if you really think about it, is becoming a new experience for you. It's becoming a challenge. This has shaken your commitment. This not being able to go to church and gather with people that you're used to. And you're starting to rethink it. And that is happening on a large scale as well. You're not alone in that. But Jesus is becoming less real to you than ever before. You're turning into a religious consumer, just downloading the content every week, you know, becoming a remote social media campaigner, getting behind all the right kind of things, and everything that you do is now in your PJs. And that feels weird to you. That's challenging your commitment. You're not sure what you're leaving behind. You're not sure why you were ever so committed to it in the first place. So the question that we can ask ourselves, the question that we have to ask ourselves in this situation is, what should it look and feel like to us to follow Jesus, to follow this Jesus, to get up close and personal with God's friend and saviour, to think about him, to listen to him to the point that we could actually trust him and maybe even to say, I love him. I'm coming to love him. And do you know what? That's the question that the first generation of Christians was actually thinking about. That's the question that they set about answering as they gathered the first stories of Jesus and into recognized volumes. They put them together and named them after their authors, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. They wrote letters to one another, kind of thinking out loud and guiding one another, guiding young Christians in how their lives would look as they started to follow this Jesus as their loving Lord, their liberating Lord. So what does it mean for a church like Colossae when they gather in somebody's home? Let's say, you know, welcome to the home of Caecilius and Andromache. They are hosting, and their adopted son, Crestus, who has come from another family, but he's adopted into this family. And they have a household with slaves. And so there is one of their slaves, maybe some of their slaves have their own children, but their slave is Onesimus. And they have friends who come along, Nympha and Philemon and Archippus. And they have fellow merchants and legionaries, you know, soldiers who are interested, looking in from the outside, not quite sure where they stand yet, but they come along, freedmen. And other people like Epaphras, who become letter carriers, the early postal service. What does it mean for these guys to participate, to share, to gather in a household, to eat together, which would have been socially very, very new, and to share together across racial and social and economic and tribal boundaries, all of those lines being crossed in this new weird family household thing called the church? The same questions existed for all of them, host and guest alike. For Roman and Scythian and barbarian and slave and freeman and Jewish exile and prison guard and where are you at? Student, uni professor, civil servant, tube driver, stay-at-home parent, immigrant, furloughed staff worker, shop worker, whatever it might be. The question is the same. How does my story, how do my relationships, my bucket list, my identity, my humanity, my hopes, my expectations, my dreams, how does that fit into the big story? How does that fit into his story? The Jesus story, the cross and resurrection story. What changes need to be made? How do I live now? Now that I've been invited to live as if the new world has begun, the new creation has begun when Jesus rose from the dead. How do I do it? How do I live? And that's the same question that we've been wrestling with all the time. That's the question that you'll answer as you read through a book like Colossians. And actually, we can see that it makes changes in two ways. One of the ways that we can look at it is our search for individual authenticity. What does it mean to be me? And secondly, what difference does it make as we search for social justice? How do we achieve a better world for everybody? What difference does this make to us together? And as we go through, what we're going to find is that in Jesus, those two things combine into an even better third option. When Paul writes to the young church in the town of Colossae, which is a town in Turkey that doesn't exist anymore, he tells them that the reason that Jesus did something for them, die on the cross for their sins, is so that something could happen in them. So if you look at verses 12 to 14, of this first chapter of Colossians, Paul tells us that through Jesus Christ we are forgiven and have been bought back, redeemed, out of slavery to darkness. And therefore, did you notice this? We have been qualified to share in his inheritance. Qualified to share. That's participation. Say that to yourself. Say that phrase to yourself right now. I am qualified to share. When I believe in Jesus, that is true. To believe in Jesus is a kind of choice that you make, but actually in a sense, it's not a choice that you make. Believing in Jesus means I qualify to share in the royal victory party. If Liverpool, the football club, ever get a chance to celebrate their premiership win, 30 years coming, on a bus ride through the city, then you as a fan, to play the illustration, to look at the picture, you as a fan don't just get to stand in the streets and cheer. That's not where you're going to be. Even though you didn't play a single minute, you have been qualified to get on the bus and to enjoy the ride. And everybody else cheers. That's the picture. You're qualified to share. You've been given the right to be called a child of God. It's actually a ludicrous picture of astonishing generosity and grace on God's part. Now, of course you don't deserve it. None of us do. But that's what we've been invited to receive. That's what's been lavished upon us, that qualification. He's lavished upon you and I that participation, that invitation to share. And that is what each of us receives. We receive the right to be called sons of God. That doesn't mean that we become male. That means we receive the equal standing of the Son of God. So Paul thinks through what he's received. And as he thinks through, he thinks out loud, he thinks through what Jesus means, and he arrives at verses 15 to 20, these superlative thoughts about who Jesus is. In real terms, he says, I'm counted as qualified. I'm invited to take part, to participate in the party with full energy and enthusiasm. I am invited to take part with my whole heart. That's what's incredible here. I am told that whatever is found in me that doesn't count, that works against me, is totally forgiven. And it will be done away with. Because when you get to verse 22, look ahead to verse 22, I am assured that the intention that God has in forgiving me in Jesus is to present me, now did you see three words there? Holy, blameless, and without reproach. That is the intention for you as you follow Jesus. Now, what I want to do is just take a moment to emphasize this, this point. Just let's make it clear to ourselves. Here, Paul is talking about your character. He is talking about a complete transformation of your heart and mind. He is talking about the entirety of your soul and strength being engaged in this. That means if anybody, at any point, your children, your parents, whoever it is, brings a word of rebuke against you, a word of disapproval, a challenge of disgrace or of shame, or even they say that they're disappointed in you, then that charge simply won't stick. That's what it means to be without reproach. Actually, that's what it means to be holy. Those charges of disgrace and shame and disappointment and disapproval, those rebukes, simply won't stick. Now, almost all of our relationships that we experience will have something of that disappointment, disapproval, rebuke in them. I know that inherently we do this against our children. And we feel it keenly, don't we, when our selfishness is exposed, when our temper flares, because we want our kids just to get on and do that. We can't wait. We can't be patient for them. They just have to do it now. Sometimes if a car is coming and they're trying to cross the road too early, we have to act quickly. That's entirely true. But actually, when our appetites are inflamed, be it food or alcohol or anything else, any of our other appetites, overeating, snacking, right now in lockdown, major issue for me. Whenever our temper flares, our appetites are inflamed, what do? We bring a charge of reproach against ourselves. And yet, says Jesus, and hear me on this, Jesus says, I can bring this self-condemnation to an end. I can bring these out-of-control desires, these selfish behaviours to an end. Because I've already called you holy. The life that you will have forever, the life that you already have in part, is there because the same power that's at work in you is the same power that raised Jesus from the dead. So therefore he can say in the middle of these verses, he's the firstborn from amongst the dead. Because it's the same power working in him is the same power working in you. And that's verse 11. And what does this do? This gives you an unshakable faith and an enduring hope that no matter what you face, no matter how dark it gets, and I know something of the darkness in my own life, you don't belong to it. It has no effective hold over you forever. You were not made for it, and it will not win out. So how can Paul say this? Well, that's because of who Jesus is. Look more closely with me at the pen picture of Jesus that Paul gives us in verses 15 to 20. What Paul's done is he's composed a picture in two halves all about Jesus. It's a poem, if you like, but a pen picture will do. In the first half, he shows us that what Jesus does is he embodies the God of the Hebrew Scriptures. This is the writings that Paul was brought up on. He is the God who created this whole place. He created Colossae, as he writes to the church there. He created Tarsus, which is where Paul was born. He created Manningtree, which is where you all are. He created the northwest of England, which is where I'm speaking to you from. He runs it. It depends on him. And it finds its identity and its purpose in him. It was made for him. And it holds together and keeps going because of him. Now, think about that for a moment. That's power. That's influence. That's importance. And all of those ways that Paul expresses, that Paul talks about Jesus, is the way that God introduced himself in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, the Scriptures that Paul was brought up on. But it's astonishing that a well-schooled, monotheistic, Orthodox Jewish man can say this about a human being. Because what Paul is saying here about a Jew would have been absolutely and utterly unthinkable for him as a child growing up and being taught, even as a young man. This is utter blasphemy. But here Paul is expressing superlative divine adjectives about a rabbi born in an obscure southern Judean village just south of Jerusalem. What Paul's doing in this poem, in this pen picture, is he's showing that the entire world is set up to be a testimony to God's glory, and the world is a place in which God is to be worshipped. The world is, the world, the cosmos, tells a story of a holy and glorious God, the story of his character, the story of his power, the story of his supremacy. He is the King of Kings, the preeminent King, if you like. He both rules and reigns. And as Paul goes on to the second half of the piece, he rules and reigns over the people that he's made, a people for himself. He's made that people through one person, in whom he dwelt and through whom he made peace when this person died on a cross, and by whom he now reigns because this person holds the highest place, the highest role. And those are the two halves, and those how they fit together. So you little fleeting Christian, or perhaps, you know, you fragile nearly Christian, you have such fragile strength. You get to be part of this story. You get to share in its eternal narrative. Because through Jesus, you've been reconciled to God. Where once you may have been out of kilter with the world, where things just didn't work, you were unable to make things work, you're down on your luck, maybe you got anxious, maybe your energy was sapped and you were run down, you may have had a chronic illness, you've been recently furloughed, or you're unable to see the future, you're presiding over that round of redundancies that you knew you weren't employed to do this. This is where the business seems to have taken you, and that's hard. Your broken paragraphs, your unfinished symphonies, your plot holes, your forlorn expectations are reconciled into his great narrative. And what's interesting is even your blooper reel, even your outtakes at the end are going to cause him to laugh with you, not at you, but with you, because even your bloopers are going to be redeemed. They're going to be part of the way that through you, God brings glory to himself. Come back with me into Narnia. Aslan explaining to the children what happened to him after he's risen from the dead, after he died on the stone table. He says, when a willing victim who's committed no treachery is killed in a traitor's stead, the stone table will crack and death itself will start working backwards. It's an amazing phrase that C.S. Lewis has included in the text there. What does it mean for death to start working backwards? What it means is that even the worst and darkest points of our lives will be part of the story and will actually work within the story to bring glory to God. Even those parts are not outside of his control and not outside of his plan for your narrative. What we're looking for in life, you see, is a place where our desires, our dreams, our longings become a reality. Where we find that our loves are in line with the way that the world is set up. Where actually what happens is we get what is right and we want what we have. Did you get that? We get what is right for us, which may not be what everyone else has. We get what is right for us. We recognize that and we want what we have. You see, our world, the world that we live in, calls us to express ourselves without shame. You know, we must be true to ourselves. I must express myself and live to be the way that I was made. I must be authentically and absolutely me. I must enact my deepest feelings with liberty and perhaps even impunity. Don't punish me. This is just who I am. I need to be authentically me. Now, the thing is, you'll get that. You'll get to do that when you're in heaven. But anywhere else, that's complete chaos. That will never work. Where your story, your loves, your dreams and your reality matches, there is bliss. That's great. But if there is even one person who stands in your way, if there's one person who gets in your way of fulfilling those dreams, of expressing yourself, of causing you to fail to complete the items in your bucket list, then I can't fulfill it. You know, maybe it's because you had kids unexpectedly and your life took a wrong turn. Maybe somebody married the person of your dreams, somebody else. Then that's hell. So what if you emptied your bucket list? Just tipped it out. Because the only reason that you would do that is because you found something vastly more important and more valuable, a greater treasure by far, something that actually you can love wholeheartedly, something that you can truly hope in. That's what would make you, that's what would cause you to tip out your bucket list. To love Jesus as your true Lord of all, the Lord of liberty, the one who sets you free, is to willingly empty your bucket list. It's to willingly hand over the reins of your life. It's to generously accept your place in his story and then let him tell it. To realize how you will end up has already begun in you. And so what we see is that the four things that we've been talking about, that justice has been done. You don't need to self-condemn. You don't need to go down that line. Justice has been done on you. The suffering that you will face will be redeemed. That your desires are rewritten and that hope is kindled. Not in what I want, but in what is truly eternally possible. Well, that's what it looks like when Jesus starts to become real to me. But what happens when we start to look outside and think about the world that we're all living in, the world that we want to achieve betterment for everybody? We look out into the world, we see, of course, we're surrounded by unfairness. And when that is historic or systemic or ingrained in some way, or even if that unfairness is unacknowledged, if we're victims of something over a period of time, then that is a true evil. What we're defining is that the effects of our current circumstances, the effects of what's going on right now, is going to affect the poorest worst by far. School closures will affect the poorer children much more severely. And that's partly to do with school lunches as much as it is to do educationally. And the financial cost to the country, which is just being calculated now, is going to affect generations to come. We're going to be paying this off. Our children will be paying off this bill for this lockdown. And as we look out, we're told by the media, we look out into our world, there's an increasing energy to the campaigns for change, using digital media and bypassing the traditional structures, the traditional societal structures, family commitments, nation states, corporate bodies, charities, the other systems that traditionally would have been previously used to effect meaningful change in our society. And organized church structures, as you see them out in the world, the church structures that we know and have relied on are mixed up in this change and not always for the best. Historically, we've not always been squeaky clean. We've been far from it. What I want to do is I want to show you just one example of how knowing this Jesus has had a wonderful effect on society. Brian Stevenson is a lawyer, a professor of law for 18 years at New York University School of Law. And he set up about 30 years ago the Equal Justice Initiative based in Montgomery, Alabama. That works specifically with death row inmates in America and looks to get relief or release for them where they have been wrongly convicted. Over the last 30 years, he has managed to find 140 of them wrongly convicted and either get their sentences quashed or them released or whatever it might be. Last year, a film called Just Mercy was released. I do commend that film to you. It's not easy watching, but it's a very heartfelt film and a wonderful testimony to some of the work that the Equal Justice Initiative does. And his TED Talk, for those of you who find TED Talks and like to listen to them, is acknowledged as being one of the best ever TED Talks. It's really worth looking up. His TED Talk is called We Need to Talk About Injustice. But what one of the things that he brings to us is this, that he says, I cannot enjoy justice and a life of freedom unless you too are enjoying it with me. That actually my humanity, he says, and my identity depends on everyone's humanity. And when your humanity is challenged by injustice, so is mine. When your identity is challenged by injustice in society, and so is mine. Mine is under threat. And therefore, if I have freedoms and privileges, I can use them for everyone's good, not just my own. Where that motivation comes from, though, is because he trusts Jesus. And because he trusts Jesus, he says this: we are always more than the worst thing we've done. And particularly working with people who find themselves on death row, that's an important message to hear, isn't it? But that comes straight out of what we know of trusting Jesus. We are always more than the worst thing we've done. He then says, in brokenness, we can be filled with grace and mercy. And he says that in order to do justice in society, he says you have to be proximate. In other words, you have to get close to those in need of justice. And when you do get close, even with the meager resources you may have, that can be transformative. Now, what's interesting is, from his perspective and the work that he has done and his the Equal Justice Initiative has done, what's interesting is that actually all of that is written throughout the passage that we've read and throughout the book of Colossians and the New Testament. It's written in this letter not that I am qualified to share in the inheritance that God's got for me, but we are. It's not that I am going to be presented holy and blameless and without reproach before Christ, before God in Christ. It's that we are going to be presented holy and blameless and without reproach before him. And I simply cannot begin to enjoy the promise of that life now without you as the person to whom I can behave in a holy, blameless way and without reproach. I can't do it on my own, and neither can you, and no one's expecting you to. The history of the church recently is that actually too many people have been expected to, and they've fallen flat on their faces because of it. What better way, what can be better for us or more transformative to us, to you or to me or to someone in need, than to stand near to somebody whose hostility, evil deeds and alienation has already been dealt with? They know that they are no longer alienated where it matters. They are no longer hostile. They don't need to be hostile. They don't need to defend themselves because they carry an inherent dignity from being brought close. Their humanity has been restored in Jesus. Someone who is living a real spiritual fundamental freedom, and who recognises that the preeminent King, the King of Kings, has come alongside them, and who is willing, therefore, to pour out their own life for their neighbours out of a loving duty to the one who poured his life out for us. If you're looking for social justice in the world, then look for the society in which perfect justice has been exercised. A society in which perfect justice has been poured out, dished out. The society where each and every member is considered righteous, just, by the sheer grace of God. And Paul says that organisation is called the church. So actually, if we've got individual authenticity on the one hand and we're looking for social justice on the other, it comes together in this person of Jesus, this who was firstborn of all creation and firstborn from among the dead, who is worshipped in the world by a people that he's created. And he will answer our deepest questions with refreshing intimacy. As Jesus leaps off the page, gets to know you better before you turn your back on him. Who will tell my story? Ask yourself this question. Who will tell my story? I will, says God. Because your story is my story to tell. I am the author of salvation. I have reconciled you to the true version of your story. Allow me, says God, to dictate the plot twists. Allow me to introduce you to desperate situations which are not outside of my control, even though they may be outside of yours. The kind of things we encounter in the Jesus story, in the Bible, chronic bleeding, violent storms, overwhelming circumstances, orphanhood, widowhood, famine, pestilence. God says, these are my specialities. This is where I can really show you what I'm like. Do you know what, says God? I can close church buildings to enable my people to open their minds and open their homes. I can put my people in strategic locations to speak and serve in powerful and particular ways just when I need them, like Joseph in Egypt in Genesis, like Jonah in Nineveh, like Stephen, the first martyr in Jerusalem, whose death was presided over by the guy who writes the letter to Colossae, like Brian Stevenson in Montgomery, Alabama, or Francis Collins, who heads up the United States National Institute of Health, who's working to bring private pharmaceutical companies alongside the government to produce a vaccine for the coronavirus. Or C.S. Lewis in Oxford, who in his studies is writing what we think as children's stories, but in fact, communicate deep truths to our hearts. Or you in your home, or you in your network, you in your neighborhood, where only you can go. He has called you to be there, right where he needs you to be, to write your story where only you can be present. So how do you share in this life of Jesus as he leaps off the page and becomes more real to you? Well, think, if you would, and if you haven't seen it, I commend it to you, the musical Hamilton. George Washington says partway through, and also at the end, "Let me tell you what I wish I'd known. When I was young and dreamed of glory, you have no control who lives, who dies, who tells your story." Those are in actual fact the very last words of the musical, Time. Who lives, who dies, who tells your story? Hamilton leaves that question hanging at the end. Doesn't want to answer it for you, it wants you to answer it. But actually Jesus gives us the best answer, the great author of salvation. Will you empty your bucket list and make space for the King of Kings to fill it with unexpected items that will show you what he's truly like? Will you willingly hold out your best intentions, your ideas? Because actually some of the good ones really aren't going to make it. Even the best ones might have to die. And let him teach you wisdom. Let him teach you how the world really works. Will you hand over control of your emotions and intentions and let him teach you when to rejoice and when you must weep and who to get close to when they need you most? Will you allow him to put you in those places where you will go? And right now is a time for weeping for many people who struggle. So that he can teach you, so that you can learn to be authentically you and communally righteous, that those two things are brought together in reconciliation with him on the cross. As he calls you righteous and makes you fit for purpose, he places you alongside others who equally need you as you need them, to forgive, to bless, to love, and to know until our hope is made real together. As Brian Stevenson says, we all need justice, we all need mercy, we all need a measure of unmerited grace. Is he becoming less real to you? Well, get your eyes off yourself and onto this Jesus again before you close them forever. Is Jesus becoming more real to you? Then, in the words of Aslan, come further up and further in. Would you allow me to pray? If it helps you, you can close your eyes and let me pray. Father God, thank you for our time together where we have heard and seen how Jesus is alive today and still at work in our world in mysterious and strange ways in difficult times like those that we are going through. Would you please lead us, teach us wisdom, show us how you are the Son of Man, the Son of God, how you are our friend and God's friend too, how you are the preeminent King of Kings, and how you would write our story to bring you glory and enter us into that story which will be told forever of a God who is great and powerful and glorious and holy and loving and true. In Jesus' name,